like all the people them want. Woman them a flex and the man them a chant. Cause the 60s style it have to come back. Draw for your bell bottom black heel and frack. Boom shakala crude boy. You me tell him no sir.
This is Infants on Thrones. Philosophies of men mingled with humor. We are the Corp.
Whoa!
Is that grown up Billy in 4C?
Hey, my name is Brady Bloom, and I am the infamous Billy in 4C.
He's got the best rare bird collection in Rhodey.
They found me on Facebook. Casting sent me a Facebook message.
Hey, Billy!
At first, I thought that somebody was pulling my leg.
Are you crazy?
But once they gave me a little bit of proof.
I hear you got a lot of flocking birds.
I've just been stoked.
Ding, ding. I'm home.
I had no clue how much those two lines that I had were going to follow me the rest of my life.
Pretty bird.
All right, so tell us about yourself, Brady.
Well, let's see. Where do you want to start? Like,
where'd you grow up?
Young, do you want to start? I grew up in Southern California, Rancho Cucamonga. So I'm born and raised Rancho Cucamonga. That.
I've always loved that name. I grew up not far from there. And yeah. Like when I was a kid, Rancho Cucamonga sounded like such a fake name.
Yeah, what
if somebody did like one of those Latino announcers to say Rancho Cucamonga
so,
or something like
who,
that?
Like, is that a person? Cucamonga is a person, or what is it? Because I get the ranch
Cucamonga
part.
Indians. Okay, actually,
all right. I'm sophisticated enough Indian. To get the ranch out of Rancho, but the Cucamonga isn't quite as intuitive.
You're sharp.
Yeah,
you're so sharp.
You know, I grew up in Arizona.
I think it was the Cucamonga Indians. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
So I haven't done the research or like read a book on it or anything, but. It's about an hour east of L.A., so I grew up right here on the fringes in the suburbs of L.A.
So how close is that to, like, Corona and Riverside and Mira Loma? And is that right in that area?
Yeah, it's a little closer than, like, Riverside or Mira Loma,
okay.
And it's a little further north.
Okay.
It's like,
yeah.
If you ever drive down the 15 from Utah coming into California,
right.
You go through the Cajon Pass or a bunch of mountains, and Rancho Cucamonga is right outside of that pass.
Okay, basically. Yeah, yeah. I think I know that. Like maybe 10 or 15 years ago, they put up a big mall up there.
That's in Rancho.
Yeah. Okay.
What SoCalers refer to that is the Inland Empire.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Yep. Rancho's kind of the heart of that. Anyway, you want to talk more about Rancho Cucamonga or...
I'm interested to know about the Cucamonga Indians and their connections to the Lamanites.
I'll do a little research on that. Okay. Maybe get some DNA evidence going.
All right.
So, like, were you okay? So, here's a question I have. You obviously were a successful child actor to get into a movie such as Dumb and Dumber at such a young age. So, talk about your parents. Like, your parents had to be involved in that, right?
Yeah, my mom was specifically really involved in my childhood, and she's an amazing woman and sacrificed a ton of time for me to be able to do it. And so my brother got into it first. My brother Brandon, he's my oldest brother. He was in Dynasty. I don't know how old
wow.
you guys are, but do you
oh
remember
my
Dynasty?
God.
I remember this.
Of course.
I don't remember watching it.
Nighttime soap opera.
Yeah.
So he was Little Blake in Dynasty series regular part. He was in Lois and Clark Superman. He was in a bunch of stuff. When I was five, like I would go to his agent that he had would have Christmas parties at Chuck E. Cheese. And so I would always go to them.
Yeah.
I think that was their recruiting tool kind of.
Huh.
But that's great. That's I was great a really idea. Outgoing. Yeah, it was fantastic. I was a really loud, outgoing. I'm kind of a self-diagnosed ADD child. But I used to be cute too. Like I had really blonde hair and I was a pretty cute kid growing up. So the agent asked if I wanted to, and I wanted to do it. And so all of my siblings, there's five of us, we all tried it. Only my oldest brother, Brandon, and I actually really worked. One of my brothers did like a commercial for Burger King, but that was about it. But Brandon and I both really liked it. And so my parents helped us to pursue it. So the first thing I did, I was actually a reading promo with Fred Savage and Dana Delaney, the more you know type commercials. Mm. And then right after that, I booked Doogie Howser. And so I was on Doogie. That was my first TV show appearance.
So that I had. What was Neil Patrick Harris like?
He was cool from what I remember. He was a really nice guy. In the episode, I was scared to get a shot, and so he compared it to my silver arrow in Zelda, and that I needed to move forward and not go back to get more hearts, but that I needed to save the princess. And so, good times, right? Back in the late 80s. And then from there, I kept auditioning and working. I worked a lot, actually, as a kid, mostly in TV, and then a number of movies as well.
What were your favorite jobs to do?
So there's a few, and I actually have my IMDb page pulled up just so I can remember it.
All right. I'll look at it, but, too.
So I was on Get a Life with Chris Elliott. I was a regular on that, actually. I was his best friend's son in that show. So that was just really cool. That was the first series regular part that I had. And so it was like a consistent job where I'd work with the same people over and over again. It says I was on 13 episodes, so I guess that's true. But
did you get
so
paid?
I got to work with. I did get paid, yes.
I mean, for 13 episodes.
I don't ask my parents. They would probably know if I got paid or not. So that was really cool. I was on the Ben Stiller Show, which also, like, that one's pretty awesome to me, too, because that, like, most people don't even know the Ben Stiller Show existed. But it was before.
That was on MTV, right?
Yeah. And it was before Ben Stiller
blew up.
Big,
yeah, right.
At all. Like, at all. And so it had him and Andy Dick, Janine Garofalo, and what's his name? The guy that plays Saul on
Bob Odenkirk.
Bob Odenkirk was on it too. And so I got to work with all of those guys before they were like well known in the industry at all. And actually,
I was gonna say, do you actually really remember each one?
Each one of them?
Or each show that you did, you mean? Is that what you're asking?
No, what I'm saying is do you have like specific memories of each one of those stars that you just listed off, or is it kind of all a blur because you're so young?
A lot of it is a blur. There's like key things that stand out to me, though. One of the things I did on that show, I was in Andy Dick's Children's Political Theater. And so I worked with Andy Dick a few times on the show. And he was hilarious to work with. There was... they actually showed it in the end credits. There was this outtake that they did of us where he was like talking to me and the other little girl that are on there and that was on there. And he said, he's like, you need to stop stepping on my lines. And we're like, we're not stepping on your lines. You're stepping on our lines. And he's like, no, I am a professional actor. And we said, so are we. And then he's like, listen, you do your job, you do it well, and then you get out of here. And then he starts storming around and he literally stomped around the entire like soundstage that we were working in for like 5 whole minutes, just stomping around the whole soundstage, just like making a show of it. Yeah, he was joking though; like it was totally a joke because we were minor, we're kids, you know. Like if he yelled at us, he'd get in trouble in real life. But it was something that we worked with him on. So like, there's things like that really stand out to me that I remember a lot more of. There's stuff though that like, almost all the shows that I was on, there's like key moments. Roseanne, I was on Roseanne. I was a trick
really?
Or treater. Yeah,
I'm looking at the IMDb now, and I'm really impressed with some of these shows.
you're on some major shit.
He was on the Corky show, The Life Goes On.
Oh my god! Oh bloody, oh blah, da.
So, I was actually the kid on the bike that one of the main characters swerved out of the way, and then he hit a tree and died in that episode. So I was the cause of death of one of the main.
Oh, you caused someone to die.
I caused one of the main characters to die.
Wow.
On Life Goes On.
That's ironic. Life goes on, except when Brady's riding by.
Oh my God, that's a really busy schedule.
Well, it's one. It's like one episode. Like you were on one episode of each of these, right? You didn't have like a big part until later.
But how much auditioning though goes into getting one?
Yeah. A lot, man. I've driven in a car more miles than any child should have ever driven, probably. No, just there were weeks though that it would be. I mean, it was at least one or two times a week that I'd be going out to auditions, and there were weeks that literally I was like gone every single afternoon, like pulled out of school a little bit early, and then we drive into LA and drive back in traffic. So I actually remember many times sitting in the car, like looking out the window and like thinking how rich I would be if I could invent some sort of teleportation device to save time driving.
So when you were on the episode of Star Trek Voyager, did you try and rip off the technology?
You know, I should have. Yeah. Star Trek was my grandpa. Like, my grandpa's a major Trekkie. He had every single Star Trek episode of the original and of Next Generation on beta recorded and like in their own like closet and everything that he had stored away. So when I booked Star Trek, my mom called my grandpa right after we found out I booked it and said, "Dad, the best thing in the world just happened. Can you guess what it is?" And he said, "What? Did Brady book a part on Star Trek?" Like, that was to him, that was the best thing. Like, he guessed.
That was the pinnacle.
That was the pinnacle, and I did it. And that's actually a pretty big part on that episode. You can find that one on YouTube. Huh. There's a bunch of clips from that on YouTube with me in it. So I was a little alien boy that helped to save the planet that we were on.
Aww.
From being destroyed.
Cool.
So good with times. all of this Hollywood, you live in Rancho Cucamonga, so that's practically... West Phoenix.
It's totally Hollywood. You know, it's major Hollywood.
Yeah. So, having this being a major part of your childhood, would you say that your Mormon upbringing was at all affected by this? Because you also said that you had siblings that were in the business.
Yeah.
I mean, your parents had to have been stretched thin. I just can't imagine them having a calling.
Dude, my dad was bishop. My mom,
wow.
He became bishop when my mom was pregnant with our fifth sibling, Kylie, the only girl. It was four boys and then a girl. And so my dad was bishop for like 3 or 4 years, and then the ward was split and it changed. But so he was bishop. My mom was taking me out. Like, there were times that they'd have to pay someone to drive me out to LA for auditions, like as like a babysitter, but taking me to auditions. There were times that I was working on set and had to have other people come with me if my mom couldn't make it, because she's raising five kids, having me in the industry with my dad. He was in sales, and so he was traveling a lot, and the bishop. I honestly don't know how my mom did it, and somehow all of us turned out okay. Like, none of us are druggies or anything else like that, depending on how you look at it, because myself and one of my other siblings may not have turned out okay in the end because we've had some faith crisis, but you never know.
So how did it work? Like, because Dumb and Dumber is pretty like edgy kind of humor, even for Mormons. You know, I mean, PG-13. You were how old when you did it?
I was 10.
10. So like, was there any conflict if your dad's bishop and you're on the show with all this potty humor and stuff? You know.
Yeah, well, and Lauren Holly's butt is being exposed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the headlights and stuff too. That's a good point. There was never really any, there were some parts that like, I wouldn't ever audition for anything where I would have to like smoke in it, even if it wasn't a real cigarette or whatever, you know?
Yeah.
So there were like things that we,
it would limit what you go out for.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause there's lots of scenes out there with 10-year-olds smoking.
There have been a few that have come up in my time, actually, but not that many.
Well, even, it would like, I don't know that I've ever watched the Ben Stiller show, but it seems like that would get kind of edgy.
Edgy.
Would it? Was it?
So, I mean, here's the thing. Like, my family is a really great, we're a really good Mormon family, like a model Mormon family, right?
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I grew up with The Simpsons is one of my babysitters, essentially, yeah. right? Like, our humor is pretty warped and twisted. That's just great. from that type of humor. Yeah. Like, and we have a really sarcastic sense of humor with me and all of my brothers. Uh-huh. So our family night ended up moving from Mondays to Sunday nights because that's the night X-Files was on. And so our family night was X-Files.
Cool.
Like, that's what we did for family night, was watch X-Files. So, I mean, we love movies and TV and everything. So I never really had a conflict in any of the stuff that I've worked on, at least.
And so. Do you keep in touch with any of these people? Like, you got Jim Carrey on speed dial and you can just, you know, call him up and...
I wish, man.
Yeah.
There's a few people. So I reached out to, when I got married, none of them showed up at my wedding, and I was sad.
Oh.
But I invited Chuck Norris to my wedding, man.
Oh, like, from Walker, Texas Ranger.
Yeah. I sent Chuck Norris a wedding invite. That's kind of cool, right?
Yeah.
How about we explore what it was like to be on the set of Dumb and Dumber? Because really, one of the greatest comedies of all time.
I agree. I have... A lot of the movie, I had the movie memorized at one point, and I have most of it memorized still. I just don't watch it as much as I used to. So it's kind of like, for me, it's even a little weird to like have been in Dumb and Dumber, you know, or like to see myself in Dumb and Dumber. But it's something that it's honestly been one of the life changing events.
Oh, sure. How many days of work was it?
For the first one, I was only on set for one day.
Okay.
Like, we filmed my
one
part.
One day.
Yeah.
My part was filmed, it was filmed in Salt Lake, actually.
I was going to ask that because I always thought it was the Salt Lake airport that Jim Carrey was running through at the beginning of the movie. I'm like, that looks like Salt Lake.
Yeah. So a lot of the movie, they started filming in Salt Lake and like Provo area where the dog car jumps. That's in, like Orem. Mm. Down in that area, I know that the apartment complex that my apartment was in was in Salt Lake City.
Okay,
and so with the audition process for that, first I'll talk about that. So I went in just first for casting. I didn't know it was Jim Carrey. Like, Jim Carrey was just, he was like blowing up at the time because he had done Ace Ventura and then The Mask.
Yeah,
so he was just like really, really blowing up.
And don't forget, Living Colors is what made him.
Right. Yeah. And I didn't really watch much in Living Color when I was 9.
It was on right after The Simpsons? Right after The Simpsons.
Yeah. Yeah, it was after The Simpsons. So I had seen a couple skits, now that you remind me of that. So the first audition, though, I just went in with a casting director and a camera, and they just filmed me. And then the second, normally you go on like a couple of callbacks for parts. But for Dumb and Dumber, they only brought me and one other kid back in. And, I remember going in and seeing that on the sign-in sheet. And I was like, okay, that's a good sign, right? 50-50 shot. And I went in to read for them, and it was all the producers and the Farrelly brothers, the casting director, just like everybody all in one room watching me. And like, I started doing the part and they were just cracking up. Like, they just started, but I didn't even get why it was so funny, honestly. This was the first time I had ever been blind in a role. But my brother was actually
but there were others, as you're saying now? This was the first time, but there were others?
That's a good point. No, just the sequel.
Oh, okay.
So
all
I guess not.
All right.
Which the sequel, it was way harder too. I'll talk about that.
Right.
Remind me to talk about that.
Yeah. It's a good story.
But So they were busting up laughing. Like, I felt when I was leaving that I had gotten the part. So I booked it, and then we still didn't even know it was Jim Carrey. My parents told me they read the script together of Dumb and Dumber, and they were like laughing out loud with just the script and the humor in the script before they knew it was Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels.
Your parents are really cool, by the way.
They are cool, man.
Right.
I've got some pretty good parents, and they've done a good job raising us too. So. I can't complain at all. And actually, I will say, the child actors that get totally screwed up, it's because of their parents. Like, I would say almost
Macaulay 100%.
Culkin. Yeah. Like, I knew kids growing up. Like, I've worked with a lot of different kids, too, that have kind of made it somewhat bigger nowadays. But a lot of the ones that are messed up now, it's because their parents really made them feel like they were better than other people because they were actors. Like, because they were in movies and things. Like they thought that their kids were better than other kids. And my parents really made sure that that was not our upbringing and not our thought at all. So tangent on that. So working on set with Dumb and Dumber, when I was doing, I guess I was talking to the producers last year when I was filming, and I guess the wheelchair wasn't even going to be a part of it at first. It was like a last minute thing. They had a wheelchair on set and they're like, this would make it even better if this kid is in a freaking wheelchair. Like, worst thing ever, blind kid in a wheelchair. And so I'm sitting in the wheelchair and I remember the Farrelly brothers talking to me and like kind of coaching me through it and everything. And they let me riff a little bit actually. And the Polly Wanna Cracker line was all me. Aww. I will say that was total improv.
All right.
Genius little 10-year-old.
Well done. Boy,
throwing in some Polly Wanna Cracker line. So we did that. And then the other line, actually, do you want me to do them for you guys?
Sure.
Right now?
All right.
I can start with that.
All right.
My voice changed. So bear with that. But. Pretty bird, pretty bird. Polly want a cracker? Pretty bird. Yes, can you say pretty bird? Aw, you're such a pretty birdie. I think that's about all that was in the movie.
You sold my dead bird to a blind kid? Lloyd, Petey didn't even have a head. Harry, I took care of it.
Pretty bird. Yeah, can you say pretty bird? Pretty bird. Yes, pretty bird. Pretty bird. Polly want a cracker?
And then,
you said, I thought he was real quiet.
That's at the end.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. That's the next line.
That's another
scene.
That's
the oh, okay. Episode.
Here we go. I just thought he was real quiet.
And next, we'll be back in a minute with the heartbreaking story of the blind Rhode Island boy who was duped into buying a dead parakeet.
I just thought he was real quiet.
And I got to see, I didn't get to see that much when, because I was there such a short time
right.
on the first,
right. yeah.
First shoot. But I saw Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels when they're like climbing out of the window and running out and the guy's peeing on the wall in the background. I saw the film.
What? Wait, say, back up.
You didn't know there's the guy peeing on the wall in the background?
Yeah, I know the guy is peeing on the wall, but that was you?
No, I saw them film that part.
Oh, okay.
That was all exterior shots, you know, so they film all the exterior shots in a location at the same time, you know.
So I haven't seen the second Dumb and Dumber. I have
to admit. Glenn.
Yeah. Sorry.
You didn't like watch it on Apple TV or something before?
No, and it hasn't been on any of the airplanes when I've traveled, so I haven't okay. seen it yet, but I will.
Well, you're out of luck. Randy, what'd you think of Dumb and Dumber 2? Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
He just doesn't want to say anything bad.
It was like they did the same jokes just with older people. I had such a hard on for that movie to come out, and I'm sorry. I'm just going to be honest. It was very disappointing.
Yeah. I a lot of people reacted like that. The funny thing to me was going to see it with like all of my in-laws and all my family, and like I had a bunch of people there, you know, but I was sitting like right next to my father-in-law, who's in the stake presidency in the stake.
Really?
Yeah. And he was dying laughing. He has a really great sense of humor, and like he likes movies a lot too. But he was dying. There's a couple scenes in the movie that are like my take on Dumb and Dumber 2. Dumb and Dumber 1 is a little more subtle in most of its humor. Mm. Like it's those inside type of jokes that like you get afterward and it's really quotable. Dumb and Dumber 2, I think, went more for like the smack you in the face type of humor that like kind of gets you to laugh out loud. There's one scene that I think is really hilarious with the train.
We may have been involved in an alien abduction, Harry. Is your butt okay? Harry! Holy crap! He took off on us! What? He took off on that. What?
And that scene made me laugh really loud out loud. So there's a lot of really good jokes in it, but it is like the plot is and the story is the exact same. Like, it's the exact same model. If you really watch it and think about the first movie, like, it follows the exact same structure. And I know that, I think that was purposeful.
Totally. It's like, I guess. It's probably the best we could expect.
I know.
You know, it's like, make a sequel to Julius Caesar's, or Shakespeare's Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
I brought that up because of the Ides of March.
Yes.
Good time. When did the movie open, by the way?
It was last October. No, November. Yeah. It was November 20th.
November 20th.
Yeah, and is it considered the sequel? Because there was one in
it
between
is.
That didn't have Jim Carrey and
doesn't
Jeff
count.
Daniels. It doesn't count. It's non-canon.
It doesn't.
It's non-canonical.
Jim Carrey, Jeff Daniels, and the Farrelly brothers, none of them were involved in it.
Oh, okay. Even the Farrelly brothers weren't.
It was the movie studio that wanted to bank off of him. Which, funny enough, I auditioned to be Harry in that.
Oh, really?
Right before I went on my mission, I auditioned to be Harry in that. It was like the last audition I went on before I went on my mission.
So, what role do you have in the second one? Is it just kind of playing off? Do you still have Petey? Like Petey?
No, I don't still have. My character is a rare bird collector. Now.
Okay, all right.
So. Like really into birds. I have like parrots and all sorts of rare birds. And so Jim Carrey, have you seen the trailer at least, Glenn?
I have seen the trailer, yeah. But
Jim Carrey had been in a mental institution for the last 20 years or something.
To play a joke on.
Yes, on Jeff Daniels. Yeah, right. And so my scene is like the second scene. I have two scenes again, like the first movie. One where I'm like with them and have a conversation with them, and then the second one where I get screwed over again by these guys. So this one was, I mean, it was cool for me because I actually got to act with Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels in this one.
Yeah.
Like, it's a scene with them where I'm talking with them.
Right.
And it was fun to work with them because Jim was like, every take is a little bit different with him. when he was crossing the street, like I remember one time, I was watching them film this, the beginning part of it, and he's crossing the street, and he like jumps like he jumps in a pool, and he starts like swimming across the street, like just like an idiot kind of. So just like everything he would do, every take was a little bit different. And part of his strategy, one thing that he does is he'll do it well, and then they'll say, okay, we got it. And then he's like, all right, now we do one more. And he'll just do whatever the hell he wants to do, you know, to just make
editor.
It funny, find something else. Yeah. Yeah, it is. So it was fun to be able to work with them.
So that was pretty recent. So you're still auditioning for things? You're still pursuing this? And like, is this your career? This is what you're doing?
I wish it was my career.
Yeah.
So no, I'm in sales. I'm in education software sales.
Okay.
That's where I make my money.
Yeah.
This, they actually found me on Facebook. The casting people found me on Facebook. And I had to audition for it as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got to tell this story, Brady.
Yeah. Okay. So I knew the movie was coming out, and I was hoping that they would bring me back in it in some way,
yeah.
You know? And so I tweeted, I don't use Twitter very often, but I tweeted the Farrelly brothers. Just, I think it was something like, thanks for cementing the words Pretty Bird in my life forever. And they tweeted me back and said like, hey Brady, you know, good to hear from you and everything. And so I was just trying to like put like a bug in their brain a little bit. But luckily like my part in the first movie is like one of the more memorable parts of the entire movie.
Right, yeah.
Like if people know them, I'm not just like the kid that's in the ski lift,
right.
You know, with Jeff Daniels or what, like. It's a pretty memorable character, and like, it's been fun. Just side tangent. It's been fun because people freak out when they find out I'm in Dumb and Dumber. Like, especially Mormons, man. Like, Dumb and Dumber is a Mormon cult classic film. Like, hands down. So many Mormon guys love Dumb and Dumber.
Right up there with Napoleon Dynamite.
Yeah. I would say Dumb and Dumber might even be more.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. Man, Dumb in and MTC, Dumb. The only times I felt like truly famous in my life was at EFY at BYU and MTC. Like, those two places, I've never taken more pictures and signed more autographs than EFY, BYU, and the MTC.
I wasn't gonna
tell anyone. When I went on my mission, I didn't want to tell anyone about Dumb and Dumber because I just wanted to focus on the Lord and like serving and everything.
Where did you go?
And of course, I went to Chile.
Okay.
Concepcion, 2002 to 2004.
Yeah.
And of course, though, my brother Dustin, who you've met, Randy, was working in the MTC at the time as like a district leader or something like that. So before I got there, everyone in the district knew that I was coming in and I was a blind kid. So it just like spread like wildfire and everybody knew. And so then it was unavoidable.
So your brother has a big mouth.
Yeah, he does. Yeah.
He's a great guy. I met him in person.
Yeah, he's pretty awesome. I've always looked up to him.
He's the professor. He's actually a professor at the University of Colorado, Colorado Springs. Yeah. Yep.
So he's the smart one in the family. The rest of us are lagging behind.
So what was the story with getting cast? Was that the tweeting story?
Okay.
Yeah. Is there more
to it? You still haven't got there yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then I got a Facebook message in my other inbox, which I don't know if you guys have ever checked your other inbox, but I've never checked my other inbox. But randomly, I was like on Facebook, and my wife was like, "Hey, check your messages." And she like saw a number by the other, and she's like, "What's in your other inbox?" She was probably just like checking up on me to make sure like I wasn't like secretly messaging people or something, you know, behind her back. But I had a message from supposedly casting for Dumb and Dumber 2. And I thought, like, I was totally unsure if it was a scam or not, because of all ways to like get in touch with someone on Facebook is really weird.
Holy crap, I didn't know there was an other. Now I'm looking at it and there's all these messages. So, hey, geez, holy cow.
Yeah, right? Yeah. So I totally could have missed that message, but like the universe brought it back around and made sure that I didn't miss that message.
Wow.
So I responded back and they wrote to me and they sent me. I had to go into audition for it. It wasn't like me and a bunch of other people. It was just me at first. But the Farrelly brothers told me that they were planning on casting for the role still. Like, they weren't planning on me being very good. And actually when I...
That's funny.
Yeah. Well, you never... It's been 20 years, you know.
Yeah, like, you were 10 at the time.
I was a child actor too, so I could have been a druggie or something else, you know?
Right.
But, and even when I came in, they said, like, when I first walked in, I don't look like myself totally anymore, like, because my hair is darker because I went through puberty and stuff, you know? And at first they were like, is that really him? But once I started doing the Pretty Bird line, in it, they're like, there he is. Like, there's, because I had to act blind and all that stuff for them to really get it. But in the casting, in the audition, I was like set on walking out of there with them telling me that I had the part, you know, which normally you don't get. But I was like, come on, like, I was the blind kid, you know. And so I'm talking to them afterward and we're laughing and everything. And then they're saying, well, okay, well, we're going to talk and we'll let you know, like, we'll get back to you and everything. And I was like, well, when is it filming? And they said, it's filming in 3 weeks. And I'm like, okay, well, let me just tell you, there's nobody else that looks as much like me as I do, right? And so they all started laughing and everything. And I had to walk out. I was walking out and going back to my car, and they sent someone out to run after me and brought me back in and told me that I was cast, that they were gonna use me again. So it was pretty cool, man.
The perfect line. Nobody that I know looks as much like me as I do.
Exactly. It's very true too.
I wanted to read to you because I was like, I know I had like I text my older brother as soon as I got out of the theater for Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yeah.
So this is my reaction in real time. Okay. So I tell my brother, imagine a song. A brilliant song where all the notes were hit just right, perfectly blended. Then imagine the musician 20 years later doing the same song, but as a remix. Only he played the same notes, simply louder. That's what this movie was to me. I laughed, sure, but was not nearly as entertained.
Yeah.
And so I think that kind of hits on precisely what you said. Like, they tried for bigger laughs. They tried, you know, more in-your-face humor rather than the subtle humor. But this, you know, yeah. The first one was just right. The second one was a remix and obnoxious and not quite as good. But that doesn't matter because you were in it.
Well, and I was in the first one too, right? Which is important. Right.
Yeah. How many of the actors in the first one were in the second one?
Just me, Jim, and Jeff. And then they ended up bringing back Seabass for and
Seabass. Oh,
that's Cam Neely. He's a hockey Hall of Famer. Oh.
So
meet me here at 2:15 for Manly Love. Mm-hmm.
He wasn't in the script. Like, that wasn't in the script at all. And when I was filming on set, I went to rehearse with Jim and Jeff first, and then we rode back in Jim's Escalade with his driver that he had back to, like, the trailers and everything. And Jim was telling Jeff Daniels and I about how he wanted to bring him back. And I'm going to share Jim's idea right now because this is not out there, so nobody knows. But the way Jim wanted to bring him back was to add a scene where they stop and Jim has to go into the bathroom. So he goes into the bathroom and he's taking a leak. And then, or he's actually sitting down. And someone comes and sits in the stall right next to him. And then next thing you see is a foot slide under Jim Carrey's stall, like trying to like reach over and touch Jim Carrey's foot. And Jim like kicks it away. And then it reaches in and gets even closer. And then Jim kicks it away. And then you see hands come out and grab Jim Carrey's legs and pull him underneath into the stall next to him. And it cuts. And then it has Jim Carrey like walking out and like going to Jeff Daniels saying, "We got to get out of here. Let's go now." And so they just leave. And then another guy, we don't know who it is, it's the younger guy, walks out of the bathroom and goes and hops in the passenger seat of a truck. And then it pans over and you see Seabass. And he says, "What took you so long?" And then Jim said he wanted the line to be something like, "Oh, I was just in there effing some guy," or something like that. So kind of a little stronger humor on that end of things. But kind of
the
a funny
scenes
idea.
That never were. Yeah. The scenes that never were, right?
Yeah. So kind of funny.
Yeah. That's one of the climaxes. That's a seminal moment in the, you know, find a happy place. I'm actually happy with what they went with.
Way to put climax and seminal right next to each other. That's pretty good.
I'm a douche.
Pretty good.
Oh, man. Well, and Jim Carrey's scream in that first movie when Seabass kicks open the door and he goes, like, it's priceless, man. And his Seabass's face, too, is priceless. Yeah, I have the whole mental picture going right now, the whole thing.
That's pretty good for a hockey player. Now he's a politician. I heard he'd gotten a little shit for
being in
doing
Dumb and Dumber 2.
Yeah.
Like, maybe that's why they didn't do that other scene for that reason. Maybe I shouldn't have said that. Oh, well. One of the cool things I want to share real quick about Dumb and Dumber 2 also. I was there for the kickoff party because my scene was filmed the first day. The first and second days, my scene was filmed of them filming. And so like the scene with Jim Carrey and Jeff Daniels, that was the first scene that they filmed together of the entire movie. And actually you can kind of tell in this second movie, like there are scenes that like they aren't as in sync, I think, as once they started filming a little and they were a little more in their characters. But, at the kickoff party, I sat down and I talked with Jeff Daniels for almost an hour. About because he was up for the Emmy, and it was the party was on a Friday and the Emmys were on Sunday, and then filming started on Monday, so it was the day after the Emmys. And Jeff Daniels won Best Actor at the Emmys for
Newsroom.
Yeah. And so I talked with him
awesome.
For like, yeah,
I was just doing a Chris Farley thing.
Okay, Chris Farley, yeah, thanks.
That really was awesome.
That was awesome.
But yeah, we talked a lot because the scene that he won it for, I think, was the scene that he found out his dad passed away on the show. But it was based, they wrote it because his dad had really passed away a year before. And he told me the whole story of like how his father passed away. So Jeff Daniels is just a class act, man. Like, he is a really, really cool guy. And another small little tidbit too of Dumb and Dumber 2 is on that first day of filming, I had to go back into the hair and makeup trailer. And I was in the hair and makeup trailer and I was like, man, that girl that's playing the young Freda Felcher looks so much like Jennifer Lawrence. Like, I was like, that's crazy. She looks just like Jennifer Lawrence. And then later I said that to the hairdresser and she was like busting up laughing because it was Jennifer Lawrence. So Jennifer Lawrence was filming The Hunger Games and they got her to come and film those scenes and be that character. She actually had some lines, but she asked for them to take them out. So
just like an uncredited role?
Yep. Oh, okay. It's an uncredited role. You see like her shoulder, like he starts rubbing her shoulder when they're like making out. That's Jennifer Lawrence's shoulder, huh. Actually.
Oh my God. Do you get paid if you're uncredited?
I'm sure she got paid for working, right? I don't know how much she got paid. And those little cameo roles, I think people do them just for fun more than anything.
Yeah.
But right. I'm wondering if she saw the movie and didn't like it and asked for it to be taken out. I don't know if that's the case or not, but
she's too big now for Dumb and Dumber 2.
I know.
So do you want to explore it all in a very
yes. Yeah, that's fine.
Nice way your faith crisis.
So you're sure. still active. You've got a calling in your ward right now?
I don't have a calling anymore, no.
Okay. When
I had a calling.
When do you feel like let's say this. How would you describe where you are right now as far as like faith crisis and spirituality and you know like the importance of the church in your life?
So I'm like I agree with kind of John DeLynn is like Mormonism's my tribe type of thing, yeah. Right? I'm past now any of like the stages of like anger or anything else like that that I first had in my faith crisis. And so I'm at a pretty good place. Like, I'm not very fulfilled at church, like almost ever, honestly. There's some times that I am and there's some times that I have good weeks or whatnot. But like, I'm trying to find spirituality again and like feel connected again. And I choose to believe in God. I can't say that like, and this, my wife and I differ on different things for sure. And we differ on this, but like, I can't say that I know that God exists. Right. Because I think you could argue either way. And there's some pretty good arguments as to why God doesn't exist. But like, I choose to believe in God because I like the outlook that that gives my life. Right. And so I'm trying to find a connection to God again. Like I have right next to me a book, the Jesuit Guide to Almost Everything. Like I'm just trying to find my connection again to God and spirituality. That's kind of where I'm at right now.
Do you have kids?
I do. They're young, luckily. I have a 3-year-old or almost 3-year-old and an 8-month-old.
Yeah.
And so like it's nursery and I'll spend a lot of my time in nursery when I go to church, honestly, depending on the week. I just go in there with my daughter to play with her sometimes.
Yeah.
So you do have to go every week?
Most every week.
Well,
yeah.
And there, I mean, I think describing it as your tribe, I think it's clear that there's a lot of important, like social importance, and just some meaning in your life that you have for the church, right?
So yeah. Well, and think about it too, like. I live right now in the town that I grew up in.
Yeah.
Like I know everyone and I also have a lot of family members
right.
that are in my stake. Like, and so not all of my family members at this time know about my faith crisis even, you know,
yeah.
And most of them don't know the extent of it to any degree,
yeah.
Which is why my wife is nervous about this
yeah.
podcast more than anything. But so for me right now, as far as staying in the church, it isn't definitely. I don't know if that'll change in the future or not. Honestly, like I can't say because I just don't know. But as long as we're living in Rancho, it makes the most sense because it causes the least amount of damage and harm.
Yeah.
Also, and that's something I want to avoid.
Well,
is harming others.
So where's your if you can speak for your wife, where is she in all this? If you also, don't want to just answer a little, it.
Like she believes in God and she believes in Jesus Christ, and she really likes the church, but she's not TBM by any means. Like, I think that's as far as I'll go talking about my wife a little.
But was she raised in the church?
Oh yeah. Yeah, she was. Super active family. Like her dad's in the stake presidency. He's first counselor in the stake presidency. My dad serves in my stake. And my dad is a counselor in the singles ward in my stake.
So it's a tough position to be in, and you mentioned, Brady, that your family, your friends, people in that area probably don't even know the extent of, you know, if you want to call it faith crisis or, you know, concerns or doubt or disillusionment or whatever it is. And I think back to my own experience with that, especially with my dad, when I first let him know about it, it was one of those classic do not do it this way, scenarios where I like wrote down all of these things. I did it by email and wrote down all these things that I just didn't like about the church. And I thought I was being clever. I thought I was delivering the blow kind of softly by saying, this is more about me, Dad, and I'm trying to figure out where I am with the church, and the things that kind of work for me or don't, or that I'm comfortable with or that I'm not. And I framed it, you know, here things that I don't like, here things that I do like. And, you know, it made him feel like I was calling him stupid. You know, like that's ultimately what it was. And his response to me was, what, you think I'm an idiot? So it's a tough position to be in, to express that, because it's so personal to the people around you. I don't know how you do go out and have those conversations with people, but have you had any experiences like that, or have you just completely been smart and stayed away from it?
No, honestly, I think it's almost impossible to avoid those conversations, really, because initially, like, that's how I've been in that mindset and I've been in that paradigm. Like, I totally understand it, right? Like, you guys talk about TBM whispering. Like, I can get in their shoes and I totally understand it, right? And I understand why they'd be mad at me even or whatnot.
Right.
When I first started...
You also know their argument. Well, I say, having been in their shoes, you also know their arguments before they're about to give them.
Right.
Because you used to use the same ones.
That makes it seem even more almost condescending to them, right? Like,
right.
We think, yeah, exactly. I already know.
But really, what it is, it's a situation where you've been in their shoes and they have never been in your shoes and they've never even conceived of your shoes.
You know what, though, Randy?
And it's frustrating.
You've only ever been in your shoes.
They can't empathize.
But look, you know, you know that we had very different experiences, like the way that we viewed the church. So you can't say that you knew things the way that I saw them.
Okay, so I'll rephrase it. The arguments I got were the exact same arguments I used to use.
Right.
Every time.
Yeah.
Every time.
But being able to recognize that, you can also recognize why, someone would feel very dismissive, or like we're being very dismissive if we take the argument, you can't tell me anything that I haven't ever heard before, because from that believing perspective, somebody that doubts, you know, or has left, it's because they didn't understand it completely. There was some kind of a hole or some kind of a gap in their understanding, and that gap just widened. And so when they try to talk to us about it, they're trying to identify that gap and fill that gap. And like, we may know that because we tried that with other people too. But
what I'm saying, Glenn, is that it's the despair that I felt looking at the TBM loved ones in my life, knowing that they can never understand where I'm coming from.
Right.
Yeah. And that's the hardest thing.
Yeah.
There are certain people that I've been able to, through my entire process, like, I've been able to pick out people that like certain comments that I have on Facebook or posts that I have on Facebook. Like, if they like enough of my liberal comments, like, I reach out to them and I'm like, hey, have you ever listened to Mormon Stories? Or, hey, have you ever done, like, just like a little code thing, you know? And it's like, yeah, I love Mormon Stories, you know? And it's like, okay, this guy's cool. Yeah. Like, I can talk to this person and relate. So there's been like four or five people. My faith crisis kind of started, I don't know if you've listened to Benji Schwimmer's Mormon Stories episode. He's the dancer that won So You Think You Can Dance, and he came out as gay, right? And he did it through Mormon Stories with John. And I'm really close friends with Benji. And so I was almost roommates with Benji, but I got married instead of moving in with him. And he's the one that introduced me to Mormon Stories, actually. And that's, like, I've always been a thoughtful member, and I've always liked deep doctrine, and I've always been really moderate as far as judging people or anything else. Like, I'm just very open, right? I've had a lot. I grew up in the industry, so I've known a lot of gay people, and they're really good people. And so, like, I was always a little more understanding and moderate on that. So I've had some deep discussions with Benji, and he introduced me to Mormon Stories. And that's kind of – I listened to Mormon Stories before for like a year and a half before I really hit like the CES letter and like really got into church history. That was like in May of last year that I really started getting obsessed with church history and like really exploring deeply and going through a faith crisis. And I found out that my brother – the one that Randy's met, I hope he's cool with me sharing this, but he was going through a faith crisis as well. He had been going through a faith crisis for like 6 years. He was kind of an agnostic Mormon for 6 years and like serving and doing everything right to try to get his testimony back. And then his wife stumbled across, as she was preparing a lesson on the priesthood, she stumbled across the Wikipedia page for Joseph Smith, which as a as a true believing member, if you hit that and you go through it, there's a lot of stuff there that you don't know about. So she introduced him to that. And so he was going through faith crisis. He had told my parents about it when he came down to California. And I found out about it about a month later and found out my mom was really upset with him and felt like I could be kind of the middle ground, right, between with me still believing in God and like trying to make it work in the church, but not believing really, you know, that I could help a little. And I think it's helped a little bit for my mom. It's really hard on her still. I know she prays for us probably every night and she cries about it probably still a lot.
I was gonna say, there's no doubt that your name is in prayer rolls constantly at the temple.
Which I appreciate.
It comes from a really good place. I mean, they care about you. They love you, and they want the best for you. And I used to put my older brother Jimmy's name in the prayer roll constantly so that he would, you know, see the light and come back. And so, like, I don't have any snarkiness about that because I think it does come from a good place.
Hey, Brady, when you started listening to Mormon Stories, so if I'm getting this right, you said it was about a year and a half before you really started having any kind of like faith crisis reaction to the things that you're hearing. Is that right?
Yeah. Like I felt like I was a thoughtful member as I was doing it. Right. Like,
so what was the appeal to you? Was it just like being a fly on the wall and hearing like conversations about Mormon things that you maybe hadn't heard before or hearing people's stories or what did you like about it?
It was a combination of the stories and also the deeper thinking, man, like really being able to think and be free to do so. Right. Mm. The first one that I listened to was Jared Anderson's breakdown of the New Testament. Right. And going through all
that's
those
a great
books.
One.
And I was like, holy crap. Like, this is blowing my mind, you know? And there were things that I would have to like, I was shelving along the way too. Right. Like things that it's like, okay, like, certain things, and there was stuff that I was totally cool with, like how quickly he glossed over the book of Revelations and saying, yeah, that was just written for their time, like it has nothing to do with the last days. And I was like, what? Like that's like blowing my mind. Like, my brain came out of my ears on that, like, seriously, like, what the freak.
So it did start like a paradigm shift for you when you're going, oh wait, there's a different way of viewing the Bible than I've ever thought of before. And like, did you accept it immediately, or did you struggle with it?
I think I accepted it pretty quickly, man. But it didn't cause a crisis for me.
Sure.
Right? My crisis hit
because the Bible was,
like,
the Bible was always a little
foundations.
The Bible was always a little suspect.
Yeah. My crisis hit when I was
as far as it's translated correctly.
Exactly, right.
Yeah. So that just wasn't translated right. Yeah. It was easy to dismiss.
So Jared just proved it.
Yeah. No, and I wasn't dismissing things, though. Like, I was collecting them more, I think, right? And the weight was just getting heavier and heavier. And, I mean, for years, though, my wife and I struggled to really get much out of church. Like, that was another thing, right? Like, I wasn't being challenged in church. I wasn't having to think or wasn't having to, like, grow, really, with what I knew in church. I taught seminary for a year and taught the New Testament, and there I did feel challenged. Like, I love teaching because it makes me study and get deeper into it, right? Yeah. But if I'm not teaching, then I'm not doing that. And so it was just boring. And so this was really exciting to me and really helped me to just be a better and deeper person, I guess.
Okay. So most of my callings in the church were teaching callings. In some aspect or another. And I was always like, I look at the church manuals and it was just so boring and obvious stuff, you know, it doesn't get very deep. And I had this thirst and hunger for deepness, depth. And so I remember like this one time I taught, it was Easter Sunday and I was teaching the priests. And one of the counselors in the bishopric came in and joined the lesson. And I had spent the week looking at all four Gospels to try to reconstruct that week before Christ was crucified. And I was just dumbfounded. There was an entire day that was missing. There's no account for one of the days of the week before Christ is crucified. So at the time I was in dental school, so at USC Institute, I had the institute director at USC at my disposal. And so I went to him before I had to teach the lesson. I'm like, what is up with, I don't know if it was Wednesday or Thursday. There's no account in all four Gospels of this day. And he says, yeah, I know what you're talking about. What we think happened was that was the day that the Lord was given to the 12 disciples of the temple rites and rituals. That was his answer.
Wow. Oh, I love that. Answer. I've never heard that before. That is the coolest thing. Oh my gosh, that's awesome.
And so I taught that lesson to priests. I mean, these are like 16, 17-year-old kids. Everyone left, but the guy that was in the bishopric came up to me afterward. He's like, I am blown away. I have never been to a church lesson this good and this in depth. And I'm like, why can't every Sunday be like this?
Yeah.
But it's not. It's
a lay clergy, man. That's why, you know.
Well, yeah, like, it's a lay clergy, but if you try to dig too deep, then you get in trouble.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, but with some people, but I mean, like, obviously there were people that really enjoyed what you shared, right?
Yeah, that guy's a really cool guy. I've known him all my life.
It's that whole mixed bag thing. I used to get that all the time, too, where some people would love the edgy stuff that I would do, and then other people were just, like, they thought it was horrible.
A friend of mine has been in faith crisis for 6 years, I found out, and he's in young men's. And he was teaching the young men about the first vision account, and he told them about the multiple accounts of the first vision and, like, went into it with them, And the whole bishopric was in the lesson, and this is all the young men. The whole bishopric's there, and he said the bishopric's faces were just like, "What the heck is this guy talking about?" Yeah. But he knows his stuff, right? And so the boys were like, "What? That's crazy," you know. But he like explained it and like made it okay, you know.
But I'll bet at the end of it, good, he bore his testimony as to why it didn't matter, or like how you can reconcile the different versions of the.
No,
he didn't.
This is not that type of guy, man. Like he's trying to help the boys be prepared for faith crisis. Like he was gone through major faith crisis. He's the one that actually told me about Infants on Thrones too. So shout out to him.
Yeah.
I don't know if he wants me to use his name, so I won't. But
don't.
But yeah, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So funny, and that's like I hope. Really, where I'm at right now is I hope that I can carve out a place in the church to be myself, to be me, right? And to be open about my true beliefs and still fit in the church. But at the same time, like, I hear things from members that it's like, that doesn't really work. Like, it is kind of a black and white religion. And I think that's the hardest thing is a lot of members that are in faith crisis that are staying in the church are trying to get that gray ground to expand a little. But it's like, if if members give that up, then they're giving up too much, kind of, with their testimonies, you know? So I'm waiting for the day when I bear my non-testimony in church. I plan on doing it at some point, where I get up and I talk about my faith crisis, and I talk about why I stay in the church, and that I can find good in the church still.
You know, right? here's the nice thing about doing that, is that it's like a magnet for people that it validates people that are also having doubts. It makes them feel like it's okay to talk about it openly. I think it also puts a little bit of pressure on the more conservative people that would rather just shut you up, and they realize, holy crap, I can't do that. You know, but so it can kind of galvanize a group inside the ward. But I think at the same time, it raises the concern of people, you know. But I think in my case, I probably still could be active if I had to be, but I'm just glad that I don't have to. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I know exactly where you are with this, because I've felt like I was there for a long time. But I got to a point where just sitting in church, like I felt like the more conservative view was winning, and less people were interested in hearing even. Okay. So I got an email, maybe a week or two ago from a listener that said, hey, can you talk about, mythology and how, looking at the church and truth claims as part of a larger mythology could help to bridge the gap between belief and unbelief. And, you know, this person was saying, I want to be able to create a space where I can stay. And I think it's looking at things as mythology. So I'd like to hear more about that. So I'll probably put together like a mini-sode or something about that. But it felt like such a difficult thing when I would be sitting in gospel doctrine and the story of Job would come up, and I would raise my hand and suggest, hey, could we maybe talk about this as something that didn't necessarily have to happen and be real in order to provide some value and some life lessons to this? But the people in the Sunday school class were more interested in looking at the characters in the story as real people, and the type of suffering that they experienced as being a mirror to the type of suffering that they experience or that we experience in our lives. And I remember especially Job's wife. They're like, let's talk. Nobody ever talks about Job's wife. So let's talk about what it would have been like for Job's wife to watch all of this and to go through this and still accept him at the end after all of this. And it just, things like that, it just drove me crazy, mainly because I wasn't interested in it, and I couldn't get any value out of taking a literal interpretation of things. So, you know, eventually it was really difficult for me to find a space to stay in. But I did have a bishop. Like my bishop at the time was great. And when I would talk with him, he's a chemist, I think, or a chemistry professor at Indiana University. And so I'm like, how do you reconcile Noah and the flood? You know, like you're a scientist, you know, you like, what do you think? And he just kind of smiled and he didn't really engage. He said, you know, there's people in this ward who come to church every Sunday because they're looking for help, you know, like spiritual help, community, love, support. He's like, and to me, that's the important thing, is to be able to provide that for people. And it was touching to me. Like, ultimately, I didn't feel like I could do it because I didn't feel like I could divorce my need for non-literal interpretation of things with the, okay, I'll accept, you know, you guys talking about Nephi as being a real person so that I can provide this love and support for these people that need it. I couldn't make that trade-off, but there's other people who do and make that work. So I don't know.
Well, see, the thing is, though, like when I really look at it, and this is the hardest thing for me, is I feel like everyone in the church, and I've done this my entire life, and my family did this our entire life. When you go to church, like you put on your perfect Mormon family face, you know, like everyone has to be perfect, and you have to like You have to look like you're perfect. And no one talks about their problems. No one talks about their thoughts, their doubts, their issues, right? Like, the most meaningful talk that I've had, that I've heard in church since my faith crisis, and the only one that I remember, period, besides the ones where people say that, like, people that are doubting are have a disease, which I've heard that happen, and I'm just like, kills me. That stuff kills me. But the best talk I've heard was a guy that talked about his depression and how he copes with depression. Mm. And it's like, wow, like, this is engaging. It's real. It, like, can connect with people. But that just doesn't happen almost ever in church. And so at the same, there's people coming there to be spiritually fed, but like, it's all surface level. And that's the hardest thing for me, is I want it to be more. And I'd like to help make it more, but I feel like a lot of people don't want it to be more. Like, they want it surface level. And so that's where I struggle.
Yeah, I think it's very threatening. And I think it's threatening. We talked about this on a recent episode. I don't remember which one it was, but it's one of the reasons I like doing these podcasts, because we have conversations like this and it forces me to talk and think through things. And then I come to a realization. I'm like, oh, I didn't realize that I thought that. That's kind of cool, because I think that I'm cool.
You know what? You're awesome.
But that the reason that you can't share the doubting stories or the times that you've made a mistake or things is because then that creates this space of validation where it makes it okay to make mistakes and okay to have doubts. And like, that's very threatening when you've got these truth claims that rest on not having doubts and everything being redeemed, you know. Do you remember?
But that sucks. That sucks.
It does, but I think that's the reality of it. I think that's why it doesn't work, because it's too threatening. And it was like with my, and I don't know, maybe this is just coming out of my own experience. My dad wasn't a cool dad like you described. We didn't watch The Simpsons. My dad turned off Ferris Bueller as soon as they talked about a piece of coal going in his ass and turning into a diamond. He's like, okay, this is off. But my dad would not accept the possibility that I could ever be content. Like if I said I'm content with my life, I'm content with the gospel, he's like, no, that's a terrible place to be, because that's when the devil gets you. You've always got to be like, I don't know, what do you have to be instead of content? Why can't you be content?
Well, and like what you were saying, just that you said wasn't okay in the church, it like rings so true to me though. It's like that it brings up this idea that it's okay to make mistakes. Right. And it's like, why is that? Like, that is like total psychology 101. Like, you have to accept that it's okay to make mistakes to like be okay with yourself.
No, but you can't do it, because then it gives people license to sin, and you can't give people license to sin. You always have to be saying, no, this is not okay. It's not okay for you to drink. It's not okay for you to mess around. You know, I'm thinking of being a teenager, right? You can't mess around with girls. Because once you start saying that it's okay, then, wow, people might do it. And they can't, because their eternal salvation's at risk, even though Jesus atoned for all of it somehow. But, it's like this whole weird – and you talked about this recently, Randy, with the Believing Christ book and the impact that had on you. It's that whole dichotomy that just didn't work.
Yeah. But the narrative that Mormons have, and I'm hearkening back to a moment on my mission where we were commissioned by the bishop to try to bring this wayward saint back. So it was a young single mother, and like, we just had no luck with her. And so we went back to the bishop and asked him, what do we do wrong? I mean, we tried everything we could. And he's like, you know, what I found is that people's behavior, their bad behavior, opens a crack in the shell around them. And that's when the adversary, or Satan, insinuates himself into that crack. And that's when people doubt. And that's the kind of the narrative that people have, is that you don't doubt unless you sin first.
Yeah, it's just so counterintuitive.
Right.
Because so, at the same time, those cracks, though, Randy, like, if you believe in God, like, God gets through those cracks. Like, that's how God comes into. If you're putting up this shell and this front all the time, like, you don't really have a true connection to spirituality. It's just all about obedience. And that's, I mean, it's at a, it's
pharisaical
situation. Yeah, it really is.
That, you know, anyway. What made me not be able to go to church anymore, because I had that conversation with my bishop that you're talking about, Glenn and,
yeah,
and Brady, because my son outed me as an atheist.
Right.
I actually
I remember that.
That's awesome.
I actually ordained my son as an atheist because my bishop was so cool. He was just so cool. And but when I was outed, you know, he pushed everything aside, and it was right after sacrament meeting. And for the next 2 hours, we went outside because he didn't want anyone else to hear what we were talking about. And I asked him the question, I like, is there a space for an atheist Mormon? At the time, I don't know how much I meant it. I felt such a connection socially with these people as their high priest group leader for 4.5 years, and I didn't want to lose all the friends.
And you don't want to betray them. Yeah, you know, right?
Yeah, I felt like, you know, I didn't want them to look at me as like a double agent.
Yeah.
All these years. Like, I meant, you know, all the stuff I said whenever I bore my testimony, or then eventually my thanktimony.
Right.
I meant it.
Yeah.
And I really love these people. Like, they were, and I still am Facebook friends with a lot of them. They're such good people. And eventually I just, so like, fast forward like 2-3 months after that conversation, because he told me, yes, there's a space for you. I will make sure that you will not be harassed. You'll be fine. You can stay in the Word. You can be, you know, I mean, obviously you can't have certain callings as an atheist. And, but I just could not bear week after week of people saying, I know, I know, I know. When what they really believe or mean is, I really strongly believe this. I really strongly believe this. And so the very last meeting I ever went to, I was released as a high priest group leader, obviously, but I went to high priest because I was still a high priest. And the lesson was on how stupid you'd have to be an atheist. And that could not have been a coincidence. Maybe it was. And then somebody raised their hand. He was an older, and I actually was his home teacher. I gave him multiple blessings. He raised his hand and said, I believe in evolution, but not in the way Darwin believed in evolution. And I'm like, I raised my hand, and my face is probably bright red by now. I'm like, what do you mean by that? And then he went on to explain that he believes in microevolution, not macro. And I'm just like, that's right out of the playbook of Christian apologetics. And and then just the way that they were like, you would have to be an idiot to be an atheist. And I was gone. Never went back.
Yeah, and I was guilty of doing that the other way as well. Like, sitting in Elders Quorum, I remember very distinctly one lesson where they were talking about Joseph Smith. And by this time, I already knew about polygamy, polyandry. I knew about some of the shady things that he was doing and how the messages that we were getting in the manuals were, you know, a spin and
redacted.
Yeah. And spun. And I felt like, boy, you would have to be stupid to accept this stuff. So I was guilty of doing it the other way, you know, not just you'd have to be stupid to be an atheist, but you'd have to be stupid to still believe this stuff after knowing this. And how can I sit in this lesson and be quiet? Like, that's just not in my nature, obviously, to be quiet through these things. And it was torture for me.
It's not in my nature either. Yeah. And that's why I couldn't do it anymore. I couldn't stand, like, I'd had to have earplugs to be able to go to church. But it would be cool because I in the hallways, I would mingle with people that are really cool and nice and, you know, great people.
But I'm sure it's going to work for you, Brady.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. Thanks. This is really this is really helping me out.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Luckily, there's iPad games that I can play during those types of lessons. You know.
Yeah.
I can read or I can do whatever I want during that time. But
your kids are very young, so sacrament meeting you can get through just because you're kids, right?
And you sit there and you pinch them so that they cry, and you have to take them out into the hallway. Like, that's a good move.
Well, the hardest thing for me, like, I've told my wife, because my faith crisis started first, and I told her, like, I would be willing to go to church the rest of my life for our marriage, like, 100%. Like, I would totally do that, no questions asked, forever. I'd already done it pretty.
So sing that. Forever.
Ever, and ever.
It's a
very long time. You started it really low, though.
I'm sorry.
Forever. Is a very long time.
Yeah.
Right. Nice. There we go.
Nice.
Yeah. Throw. Anyway, that's ridiculous. I've totally lost my train of thought. That's fine.
You told your wife that you would.
The hardest thing. Okay. Yeah. The hardest thing for me is thinking of my kids going through primary and going through young women's or young men's, and it's like. Already my daughter like says stuff and like talks about like Joseph Smith and other things, and I'm like, ah, like it kills me. And I'm like, I was reading this morning with her this Plan of Salvation book, right? Like, it's a comic Plan of Salvation book, and I have to go through it, and I'd be like, yeah, where do we live before? We don't really know, honey, but this is an idea. Like, this is, and I have to like skip pages in it. And I'm like, I don't really believe that. And so it's like, I'm totally cafeteriaing everything. Right. And just trying to find the good. Cause there is a lot of good in the church, right? There's a ton of good, but like for me, what I'm trying to do is take the good from the church and then take the good from other things as well. I take a lot of good out of atheism. Like, there is a ton of good in atheism.
Secular humanism is the moral compass of atheism.
Right. Well, and even just the idea with atheism that there is nothing after this life. Like, for a lot of Christians, that's totally threatening, right? But for me, it's like, okay, that means I've got to live my life. Like, I have to live now. I don't live later, so I've got to do it now. If I want to make a difference, I've got today or tomorrow to do it.
Yeah,
right?
But the way that you get around that, if the believing, is by saying that this whole huge expanse of eternity is impacted by this small, minute time now. So, like, the things that you do now do impact. I mean,
it's the same message.
It's like the inverse, but the outcome is the same. Like, life is still direly important to live.
Right.
I mean, I've heard the argument the other way, but I don't think that you have to absolutely accept that argument.
No, totally.
Yeah.
I've toyed with the idea of doing a podcast of like bringing on different people, like atheists, or bringing on these different, and trying to find the good in like every belief that's out there. And like, milk it for what it's worth, right? How does it make life better or more joyful or more full of service or other things? Like, I've toyed with that idea, mostly because I'm obsessed with podcasting, right? Yeah. And I'm obsessed with listening to you guys and all these other podcasts that I'm addicted to.
Yeah.
The one thing about Mormonism, so Glenn, counter this with your TBM whisper.
okay,
is you like, okay, let's say you ascend to a level, and I had in my high priest group the first counselor in the stake presidency, and I was like just kind of chewing the fat with him in the hallway after class. I'm like, his dad was a legend. There's a high school named after his dad. I mean, the guy was a legend. He was a stake president, and then he just dropped dead from a stroke while he was hiking in Arizona. And I said, so what was it like to be the son of your dad? You know, the guy was a legend. And he's like, well, we didn't think too much of him. He was not around much. And so what happens in Mormonism, if you ascend to this level, is like, you're not around for your kid's childhood. And especially if you have like 5, 6, 7, 8 kids, you can't possibly divvy up your time enough to really be there in their lives during these this childhood. You know, the way they rationalize that away is they're like, well, you know, they're going to be sealed to me for eternity. Well, to me now as an atheist and a secular humanist, is like, I am acutely aware of how precious and how fleeting my kids' childhood is, and I'm going to be there for them every step of the way that I can. So what do you have to say to that, Glenn?
Well, that's why I resigned from – I was in Young Men's. That's why I resigned from Young Men's, because first off, I wasn't – like, I was going through faith crisis, and so I wasn't, like, as dedicated as I felt the Young Men needed someone to be. But in addition, it's like, okay, I can spend my time with these boys who all have good – it's not like I'm, like, helping, like, low-class, like, people in the slums or something. You know, it's not like that type of service. It's like, these are just your average kids. They're all doing pretty well, and they all have good families, and it's – they're fine. You know, they don't really need my help. So I can spend my time with them, or I can quit this calling and spend my time with my kids. And that was what I decided to do. So that's why I resigned last year from my calling.
Right. But if you believe that these callings are coming from God, and you really believe that, and God assigns you to be a leader and a support for this group of people, whether it's, you know, as a bishop level or a state president or whatever, then you feel like you're doing what the Lord wants you to do, and he's going to take care of your family. So even if this kid goes, yeah, we didn't think much of dad.
This kid, no, this is a assistant superintendent in the school district of the area.
What I meant was the relationship between his father and
him and his father.
So the person didn't respect his father. So as a TBM person, I would probably say he doesn't have enough faith because he's being selfish. And it's kind of the same argument, BS argument. I'm not supporting it, but it's the same kind of an argument that you hear supporting polygamy in groups that still practice polygamy, where this was instituted by God as a way to root out jealousy. So if you've got wives that feel like they're neglected from, you know, or they're not getting enough of their husband's attention, well, they're just giving into jealousy, and they need to repent of that, you know? So you take that same line of thinking and say, with the kids, don't realize that they're being taken care of, they're in a great situation, and the Lord has called their father to help these other people too, and this is part of the sacrifice of mortality to spread the kingdom of God. So that would be my TBM whisperer response. You don't have to accept it.
Obviously, I don't accept it, but the real world, the reality of the situation is that you don't get to see your dad very much, and that's so precious to me. It is the most precious thing, other than my wife and our relationship, is the closeness and the intimacy I have with my kids.
Sure.
So, and that's a sacrifice, honestly, that Mormonism asks of you.
Somebody who really believes they're going to be okay with it.
Right.
Well, and their values are a little different in that way. Like where he finds his value is in all of the people that he's able to reach out and touch. Right. And so, like, when he died, he probably felt very fulfilled as a person, the person that died. Like, his kids didn't feel as fulfilled, which sucks at the same time. Like, so, I don't know, it's twisted, but it's like, for him, he was probably really happy, right? Because he's helping all these people, but...
I don't want to denigrate the name or the memory of this guy, because high school is named after him. So obviously he lived.
Yeah.
Oh, this is Brother Cucamonga.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Of course.
No, this is, yeah. Anyway, but what he sacrificed was something that I value above what he achieved, which is, ironically, no failure outside of the home can compensate for failure in the home, which is a Mormon quip.
Yeah, but I think that's meant towards women, though, Randy. Not towards
men. Oh, no, it's meant towards men. But like the measure of success is still your obedience, and you know, like you're never supposed to turn down a calling. So if you turn down a calling, you're not being a good example to your kids, and you're therefore a failure in your home.
You're no matter what, you're screwed.
You are such a good TVM whisperer, Glenn. You're like a savant with that.
All right.
Oh.
All right. So we've got about an hour and a half. Are we good? Is there more that you wanted to talk about, Brady? Like, how are you feeling with this? Like, are you thinking that we'll be able to go with this? Or are you nervous about it?
I think so. I think we'll be able to.
Yeah.
I do. Well, do you guys want to talk about Last Man's really quick? Let me tell you a little bit about Last Man's on Earth.
Oh, okay. Yeah. And then you also did one that was like Alma something. What was that? It was like a church thing. You got to talk about that.
Oh my gosh, don't make me.
It's on that. There. It's on there. So what?
I was Elder Johansson, right?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. So Last Man's, that's different than there's like a show now that came out, this Last Man on Earth, but this is different than that.
Oh, yeah, this was before that. So yeah. I made a web series with some LDS guys primarily called The Last Man's on Earth. It's actually – it's pretty funny. Like we did 9 or 10 episodes I think on the web series, and then we're all like, let's make a movie. And we made the movie. But the coolest thing – I think the coolest thing about the movie is the bad guy is the Oracle, and he is Joseph Smith Sr. in all the church movies. And he is freaking hilarious. His name's Rick Macy. Do you know who I'm talking – he was Helam also in the Testaments movie. Have you seen that?
Yeah. I know the actor, yeah.
Yeah. So that guy is freaking hilarious. Like, he is so funny. And then also, one of the other guys is Jesus in a movie that's coming out right now. And, like, it's just such a stupid, like, funny movie. It's super low budget. But I just – it's so filled with, like, little Mormon people that it's funny to me because of that.
Where's the contaminant virus?
And the blind kid from Dumb and Dumber.
Pretty bird. Yeah, can you say pretty bird?
Viewers are raving. Wow, this actually looks like a real movie.
I could show you a world of indescribable wonder.
Is that a lyric from Aladdin?
It's from my heart.
And Aladdin.
An assault on my brain, but pleasantly so. The Last Man's on Earth.
And then Alma and King Noah's Court. I was in a boy band back in the day.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. It was a barbershop group that transitioned into an R&B boy band. And
what was your part? Like, what musical part did you have? Were you
tenor? I was high tenor. My voice hadn't changed yet, so I can still sing high tenor, too. But, So our boy band's name, we were all a bunch of white guys singing R&B, and our group name was White Chocolate.
No.
I'll let that one hit, right?
Let that soak in for a little bit.
I'm ashamed of that. But
That's worse than Vanilla Ice.
Yeah, it really is. So one of those guys made like some church movies that had music in it and everything else. His name's Aaron Edson. He had a church album too for a while that was big on the missionary like ripping CD list. It was like all over the place in missions. But he made these movies and he like asked me to come up and be this missionary in it. So I honestly totally wish I could get that off my IMDb page, because that's just embarrassing to me, honestly, to have it on there.
Pretty bird. Pretty bird. Hey, this is Billy in 4C from Rhode Island. Yes, that's right. The blind kid from Dumb and Dumber, and now Dumb and Dumber 2, too. Yes, a pseudo-celebrity Mormon. Infants on Thrones has helped me come to grips with the tragedy that I've seen. Well, heard about at least, when learning that the thing that mattered most to me ended up being dead all along. I mean, Petey didn't even have a head. If you heart the show as much as I do, please leave a 5-star review on iTunes, write a short review, and oh my heck, why not post about it on the social media? Unless you're still stuck in the Relief Society closet about your faith transition stuff like I am. And always remember, I just thought he was real quiet. Anyone for the closing prayer?
Thank you for listening to Infants on Thrones.
Infants on Thrones.